I'm Robin Young. It's Here and Now. Coming up, a dissenting voice. Andrew Bacevich says the military surge in Iraq is not working. He'll outline his plan for what he feels should be happening right now. But first, the Pentagon is recommending the death penalty for six high-profile 9/11 terrorists now being held at Guantanamo Bay, including Khalid Sheikh Mohammed, the self-described mastermind of the 2001 attacks. If a military judge approves, the six men will be tried together, possibly by May or June, for murder and war crimes in connection with the terror attacks. Pentagon legal advisor Brigadier General Thomas Hartman insisted that the defendants will have legal rights in a fair system.
It's our obligation to move the process forward, to give these people their rights. We are going to give them rights. We are going to give them rights that are virtually identical to the rights we provide to our military members, our soldiers, sailors, airmen, and Marines who fight in the battlefield.
But the move of charging the men is seen as a risky legal strategy in a military court system that is unfinished, that still faces legal challenges, and has prompted criticism around the world. Well, joining us on the line, Wall Street Journal reporter Jess Braven, who broke the story over the weekend. And Jess, we found out more today. The 9/11 attacks took place 8 years ago. So, first of all, why has it taken so long to bring these charges?
Well, I think it was not quite 8 years ago, but it has taken them a long time for a number of reasons. One, the number one suspect was not captured initially. Osama bin Laden remains at large, as does Ayman al-Zawahiri, his deputy. So in a sense, they had a couple levels below the top echelon of al-Qaeda that I think many Americans were expecting to see rolled up right after the U.S. Went into Afghanistan in late 2001. Secondly, it has to do with the priorities of the Bush administration. Within the Pentagon, where there were officers working on plans for military trials in late 2001 and 2002, there was a lot of interest in putting the suspects they had captured on trial publicly, quickly, to try to establish both not only their guilt for judicial purposes, but also to lay bare the al-Qaeda conspiracy to a world, parts of which, including in the Muslim world, where people were skeptical. Instead, the Bush administration kept a lot of these suspects in secret CIA prisons overseas for interrogation purposes, and some of those interrogations were quite severe, as we've since learned, and there wasn't really a political will to take them out of that secret world and put them to trial, even a military trial, because much of what has happened over the past several years will certainly become an issue.
Well, over the course of the next few days, we're going to take a look at the court system under which these men might be tried. But for the purposes of our time today, it's one thing for the government to charge these men. But is there any sense that anything will come of it, the trial system itself being challenged in court?
Well, I think that it'll be quite a while until an actual trial begins. None of the six defendants has an attorney. They're being appointed attorneys now that the charges have been sworn, as they say, against them. But the government has had 7 years to put together a case, and the defense attorneys are starting at zero. So there's going to be a lot of what they call discovery and other issues involving what kind of access the defense is going to have, even getting security clearances for the defense lawyers so they can look at much of the evidence the government has will be an issue, since the government has been quite parcimonious in making these detainees available to attorneys to date. We can expect that the defense will want to conduct its own investigation and not simply rely on what the government has found, and that could add to delays. One thing, though, that that's sort of unknown is what these defendants might do themselves. It's quite possible that rather than try to evade guilt and avoid a trial, perhaps they would like one. Perhaps they would like to have the stage on which to declare what they believe and why they may have done what they've done, and so maybe they won't want all those delays and procedural protections. We really don't know. So that is one great unknown.
A lot of questions today, along with the news that six men have been charged in the 9/11 attack, six Guantanamo Bay detainees. Jess Braven covers legal issues for the Wall Street Journal. Thanks for getting us started.
My pleasure.
Well, to Iraq now, where Secretary of Defense Robert Gates today for the first time endorsed the idea of a pause in the withdrawal of U.S. forces from Iraq.
I think that the notion of of a brief period of consolidation and evaluation probably does make sense.
Gates spoke in Baghdad after a meeting with General David Petraeus, who's been hinting that this summer, after the withdrawal of the so-called surge troops, any further drawdown of the remaining 15 combat group brigades in Iraq should be put on hold. But as Gates also asked today, what happens after that? And when the surge troops leave, will the thinking be that the surge worked? Well, our guest today says no. He writes in a Washington Post op-ed that at best the surge has created a stalemate, holding violence down rather than leading to the political solution as it was intended, that Iraq is a non-functioning country. Well, retired Army Colonel and Boston University professor Andrew Basevich is a critic of both the invasion in Iraq and the war in Iraq. He was long before his son Andrew, an Army lieutenant, was killed in combat in Iraq last year, and we welcome him as always. And, Professor, let's start with a rebuttal to your conclusion. Bing West, former Marine, quotes a commander in Iraq as saying, "My soldiers have given their blood to feed these fields. Now we harvest good crops." West goes on to say, "What's startling to him is not the divisiveness over Iraq, but our soldiers' ability to quell a civil war insurgency and the violence there." And he compares Petraeus with General Matthew Ridgway, who turned around the U.S. Army in Korea in 1950. All told, he says the surge is a success. Your thoughts?
Well, of course, Bing West has been seeing victory around the corner virtually since the invasion began. So, and perhaps someday he may actually be right in that regard. But the comparison between Petraeus and Ridgway is an interesting one, and we need to remember exactly what Ridgway did. Ridgway took command of 8th Army in Korea in December of 1950 at a time when, yes, U.S. and Korean forces were being overwhelmed by the Chinese who had just intervened in the war. And Ridgway did stop the retreat. Ridgway did restore an effective defense of South Korea. Ridgway didn't win the Korean War. The war continued, and the war continued until there was a negotiated settlement, and the war ended in a draw. And I think that in some respects, is what Petraeus has done. He hasn't put us on the road towards victory. If victory means imposing your will on the enemy, he's put us on the road to a protracted stalemate. And the question becomes whether or not continuing that stalemate serves the interests of the United States, given that the Iraq War is not the global war on terror. It is simply one aspect of that global war on terror.
So what happens now? Because Bing West also compares Petraeus to General Ulysses Grant, because the name of the surge was the Anaconda Strategy, and this was a comparison to the end stages of the Civil War. And as Bing West writes, similarly, Iraq will take years to sort out some, you know, John McCain is saying perhaps 100 years. Are you saying just pull all troops out?
No, my own view would be this, that what we should do in Iraq is to the president, whoever the president is, whether it's the current president or the next one, should call his commander in Iraq and say the mission's changed. And the mission now is one in which we are going to, with all due speed, draw down the U.S. military presence. Let the general in charge decide what the tempo of withdrawal should be. But to acknowledge that simply continuing the combat presence is not gaining us any significance. Having said that, we ought to the extent that it appears that there is some likelihood, some possibility of the Iraqi government gaining its footing, achieving legitimacy, then it probably makes sense to continue to maintain a U.S. Military presence devoted to training and equipping Iraqi security forces, not chasing insurgents.
How do you do that, though? Because insurgents don't get chased. They come to you. So let's say there's a reduced number of troops just to try to help the government pull itself together so that it's not just a complete vacuum. And then there's increased bombings, as there have been, as insurgents tend to do. And so the thinking is that the Americans can't take the headlines of, you know, the insurgent attacks, and there aren't we back in that sort of either you bring in more troops to tamp down the violence?
You know, my own perspective really is rooted in the assumption that the people of Iraq will determine the fate of Iraq, and that we cannot do so. So if there is the potential for a legitimate government, if Iraq has a future as a coherent nation state, then the Iraqis will sort that out. When I say withdraw the U.S. combat presence, I don't mean just bring everybody back to Fort Hood. I believe that we need to maintain a U.S. military presence in the region, probably not an army-heavy presence. The issue here is not boots we can put on the ground. It's probably an Air Force and naval presence, which will give us some capacity to use force as needed against any terrorist entities that, you know, are able to set up shop in a place like Iraq.
So, wait, and by the way, what do you think will happen on that count? Do you think that the withdrawal of combat troops and the majority of combat troops from Iraq will open up a void into which foreign fighters and insurgents will run? Or do you think they will leave if, in fact, U.S. troops aren't there? Who wants to be in the middle of a fight between Sunni and Shia?
Well, I mean, I wouldn't pretend to know. I would insist that nobody knows. I mean, that all the smart people in Washington who claim to know are as much are guessing as much as anybody else. But the principle, again, is one that Iraqis will decide their own fate. I myself would guess, merely guess, if Iraq is a nation state, that is to say, if the majority of the people actually view themselves as Iraqis, then they're unlikely to want to have a bunch of foreign fighters making Iraq into a base from which to wage a global jihad. But that remains to be seen. We ought to maintain sufficient presence in the region so that should that eventuality occur, we can deal with it. Deal with it not by launching a new invasion of Iraq, but by surveillance that identifies terrorist activity and that takes it out before it can actually be mobilized against us. And the United States Air Force and the United States Navy have that capability.
And you were just saying to have those troops on the perimeter in other countries, perhaps, watching the area ready to come.
Or offshore.
Offshore, mm-hmm. Okay. Well, and what happens with the combat troops? Are you also saying, you know, in saying that Iraq is not worth the loss of treasure now, are you saying send those combat troops to where we know the al-Qaeda forces are, the border of Afghanistan and Pakistan?
Well, I do believe that Afghanistan's more important. And to the extent that I think Gates is probably right.
In calling for NATO to bring more troops in?
Well, or more broadly, that the forces committed on the ground in Afghanistan are insufficient. And I would want to emphasize here that the importance of Afghanistan is not simply Afghanistan. The importance of Afghanistan is its proximity to Pakistan, the most dangerous country in the world as far as U.S. national security interests are concerned is Pakistan.
That's Andrew Basevich, a former Army colonel, respected military analyst, and a dissenting voice who's saying that the surge in Iraq is not working. Andrew is also a professor of history and international relations at Boston University. We're getting his thoughts today on what should happen. We'll have more in 1 minute when we come back here and now. Later in the program, the youth vote. Many turning out because of the war in Iraq, and they're turning out in big numbers. But first, we're back with retired Army Colonel Andrew Basevich. He's now professor of history and international relations at Boston University. Before the break, he was saying U.S. combat troops should be pulled from Iraq and sent to the more dangerous borders of Pakistan and Afghanistan. But, Professor, we want to ask you, we hear all the time from people who were against the Iraq invasion, as you were, from the start. And now they say, we broke it, we have to stay with it. You know, pulling out would let Iraq spiral into civil war. You've said Americans may have to stomach some of that. But is that it?
My withdrawal strategy would have a diplomatic component. And the diplomatic component really gets to exactly that concern that you just expressed. And it's a real concern. I mean, there's no question that that's a real possibility of anarchy within the boundaries of Iraq that could go on for a long, long time and that therefore could potentially spill over. So the focus of a diplomatic strategy is to try to prevent that spillover. I mean, this is a point that was made, well over a year ago now by the Iraq Study Group when it announced its report. And the point simply is that the diplomatic priority of the United States in the region ought to be to try to put together a coalition of states that have a single common interest, and that interest is to prevent an Iraq fallen into chaos from causing chaos in the entire region. And my own guess would be that even countries like Iran or Syria, with which we have huge disagreements on other issues, would share our conviction that disorder in Iraq needs to be contained to Iraq. So that ought to be this containment strategy, primarily political and diplomatic, ought to accompany and in many respects transcend the military withdrawal. The issue, to the extent that there is a solution to Iraq, the solution is going to be a political one, not a military one. And in that sense, when so much of the conversation focuses on the battlefield itself, I think that actually leads us in the wrong direction. If I could just say one more thing.
Please.
Because it really gets to the surge strategy was sold in Washington and has been sold in part to try to get the Iraq war off of page one of the papers and back to page five and six. And it has succeeded in that particular respect. It succeeded brilliantly in that particular respect. But the advocates of the surge are basically peddling a line of reasoning that would suggest that now that the surge has had this supposed positive effects, that somehow that vindicates the decision to go to war in the first place. In some respects, I think the most important issue, at least in terms of national security policy, that ought to figure at the very center of the political campaign that's now underway is right there. Take the best case. Take whatever you think is the best case for Iraq. If that best case occurs, will we then judge in retrospect that the decision to invade Iraq back in 2003 was a good idea? Should we then consider this approach to foreign policy, preventive war aiming at regime change, does it have application elsewhere in Iran, in Syria? I mean, my answer to that is emphatically no. So to me, the most, I think, malignant aspect of the debate about whether the surge is working or not is that it changes the conversation.
In fact, some of your critics have said that your inability to see any success in the surge is because you don't want to see a success in Iraq. And that would seem to follow your reasoning that they are seeing the success in the surge as success in an invasion in Iraq.
Exactly right. Again, let's say Petraeus is a mixture of Ridgway and Grant. What's the best solution? Well, probably the best possible solution is that we're going to be in Iraq with probably 100,000 U.S. troops or more for probably another 5 or 6 years. That'll put us up to what? 2014? At which time, again, best case, we'll be able to start withdrawing and be able to say Iraq has become a self-governing entity. Well, I would venture to guess that at that point, we probably will have invested somewhere between $2 and $3 trillion of money that we actually don't have. It's all being borrowed. We've already lost just shy of 4,000 U.S. soldiers. Let's set aside the tens of thousands of wounded. Let's set aside the tens of thousands of Iraqis that have been killed. By that time, we probably will have lost 6,000, 7,000, 8,000 U.S. troops. Will that have been a wise investment? No. Should we then view Iraq, even under those circumstances, as a, quote, victory, as a success? No. What we need to learn from this enterprise is the folly of thinking that preventive war to overturn regimes, however odious, somehow provides the mechanism to advance our security interests or, if you believe in the freedom agenda, to spread democracy. this entire enterprise has been just the greatest folly. And the alleged success of the surge ought not to distract our attention from that core fundamental truth.
Professor Andrew Bacevich, his book, The Limits of Power, will be published later this year. Thanks, as always, for speaking with us.
Oh, thank you.
And again, Andrew Bacevich, a history professor at Boston University, a former soldier, obviously, and father of a soldier who died in Iraq last year. Well, in the coming days, we're going to have an opposing view. An analyst will make the case that the surge in Iraq is working and troops need to stay. And tomorrow on Here and Now, you may feel that the current subprime housing process has nothing to do with you, but when properties are left vacant, cities pick up the tab to care for them at a cost of $166 billion across the country last year. That's tomorrow. Still ahead, a book from Britain that's not about Harry Potter. Here and Now. Arkansas Governor Mike Huckabee has sent lawyers to Washington State to investigate this weekend's Republican presidential caucus there. The state's Republican Party chair called the race in John McCain's favor on Saturday night, but Huckabee claims 1,500 votes were never counted, and that could have been enough to give him the lead there. Meanwhile, Huckabee pulled off surprise wins in Kansas and Louisiana over the weekend. Right now, Huckabee trails McCain in the overall delegate count by 719 to 234, but Huckabee says he will stay in the race until a candidate wins the 1,191 delegates needed to gain the nomination. Meanwhile, on the Democratic side, Hillary Clinton changed her campaign leadership after Barack Obama swept primary contests in Louisiana, Maine, Washington State, Nebraska, and the Virgin Islands this past weekend. Part of Obama's success has been his appeal to the youth vote. Well, since the beginning of the campaign, young people have turned out to vote and campaign for Obama in large numbers. But John Delavolpe from the Institute of Politics at Harvard University's JFK School of Government says Hillary Clinton changed her strategy as a result of Obama's wins. We spoke to him last week, and he said Clinton started making headway with younger voters right after the Iowa caucus.
We saw dramatic changes from when the campaign started in Iowa and in New Hampshire. As an example, Barack Obama won the youth vote in Iowa by a margin of 5-1. And what Hillary Clinton's campaign has done is understood that and made dramatic changes within the campaign and within her message to go out and target young people, not expecting necessarily to win young voters, but to cut into his margin. And she's done that very effectively.
Do you have the numbers from Super Tuesday?
As an example, she went from Iowa to New Hampshire. She cut his lead from 5-1 to 2-1, which made her very competitive and obviously won the state of New Hampshire. In Massachusetts, she actually won the youth vote. It was the only state where she won the youth vote. It was close. She won it by a point. But that's a significant increase in where she started from.
Do you know what she did, by the way?
She made an effort. You know, she made an effort and she connected to people. Young people have told us for several years now that they want to be engaged in the process, but they want to have a two-way dialogue. And up until basically the New Hampshire primary, that dialogue was a one-way dialogue between Barack Obama's campaign and the young people of America. Hillary Clinton's campaign or strategist got the message. They started to reach out to them and talk to them in very meaningful ways. And a number of young people found a message that they could connect with.
Here in the Massachusetts area, she went to Clark University, for instance. I mean, actually physically went to speak to young people. Well, overall, what did you see about youth voters? Was there was a huge increase in the electorate on Super Tuesday, but was there also a huge increase in young voters?
Yes. Overall, the entire pie, that is the electorate, has been increasing steadily from 2000 to 2004 to 2008. But what we've seen is no slice of the pie has increased greater than young people. Okay. So, for instance, on Super Tuesday in Connecticut, young people represented 10% of all votes cast, whereas in 2004, they represented 5% of
double.
All votes cast.
I mean, that's
double. In fact, in most states, including the general election of 2004, more votes were cast by people under 30 than over the age of 65.
In the Democratic
The Democratic primary, this cycle, and in the general election in 2004. So we fully expect in the general election in 2008 to have more votes cast by people in their 20s than people over the age of 65.
Oh, well, that sends a clear message to candidates. What about the Republicans? We remember when Ronald Reagan famously lit a fire in a whole new generation of young voters.
Young voters are still looking for the inspirational figure to rise from the Republican Party. We've conducted focus groups in Florida. We've conducted a national focus group online a couple days ago at Harvard. We found no single candidate connecting with this young vote. So on Super Tuesday in the South, Mike Huckabee ran up large margins of victory among young people, whereas in the northeastern states, John McCain did particularly well among young people, and so has Mitt Romney in some other states as well. So there's really no single candidate that's captured the attention of the young Republicans this year.
Are they, you know, you're saying they did well, but just to put it in context, are they doing the kind of numbers, you know, that the Democrats have?
No, they're not. Yeah. And they haven't made that effort. I believe that young Republicans are yearning for a candidate to connect with them and to reach them.
Did they tell you that?
They did. And we conducted some focus groups and some interviews in South Carolina the day before the South Carolina primary. Every single Democrat in the room, 18 of them, small number, but every single one of them, have been contacted, not once, by one campaign, but by several campaigns for Democrats. We conducted the same research in Florida the day before the Florida Republican primary, and only one or two young people were contacted by a campaign, and most of those people were either Ron Paul or Hillary Clinton.
Huh, that's fascinating. So what is it that young people tell you when they're contacted they want to hear?
They want to hear the truth. You know, we ask them, if you could ask any question to the candidates, what question would it be? And the first thing they say is, why should I believe you? Tell me the truth. They're very, very concerned about the economy. They're very concerned about the moral direction of our country. They're concerned about, you know, today's young people not getting the same education that they got just a few years ago. And they're obviously very concerned about immigration on the right. If you're a Republican, they're very concerned about our path out of Iraq. If you're a Democrat, on the left. So it's a fallacy to believe that young people have a different agenda than everybody else. Yeah. Sure, they view some issues differently, especially as it relates to globalization. But by and large, they vote on the same series of issues that older people vote on.
You know, it sounds so wonderful to hear a young person demanding the truth. Do they tell you how they know the truth?
They can sense this authenticity that Barack Obama has had over the first year of his campaign, that I think that when Hillary Clinton understood the message from Iowa, stopped and began listening and connecting with people. What we found is that young people are not a monolith. For example, young people in their later 20s who are concerned about the economy, losing their job, concerned about health care, are more likely to be supportive of the Clinton campaign. As an example, on Super Tuesday in Los Angeles and California, young Latinos were overwhelmingly supportive of Hillary Clinton. Regardless of their age, they're voting as a block around kind of the community that ties them together. In some cases, it's age on a college campus. In other cases, it's race or gender or religion or issues based.
With the young people who might even be younger, let's say college age, who support Barack Obama, was the war, for instance, more of an issue for them?
The war and the idea of kind of a new era of leadership. And young people, especially Democrats, are very concerned about America's place in the world. They're very concerned about our image and their image. And they see that Barack Obama as the best person to kind of repair this image and increase the United States' presence as a partner in the global community.
John Delavolpe is director of polling at the Institute of Politics at Harvard's JFK School of Government. He's been telling us about the youth vote. He's been tracking it for how long?
We started tracking them in 2000. So we now see the kind of the oldest members of what we call the millennial generation are about the age of 30 now. Uh-huh. You know, so we have been able to track this generation from more or less from the beginning when they came to age.
And as you said, at 30, they are the key, at least on the Democratic side, they're the key voter.
They are. And what we found is that the more you engage as a younger person, you stay involved in engaging and voting and participating moving forward.
John, thanks so much.
My pleasure. Thank you.
John Delavolpe from the Institute of Politics at Harvard. And we'll see how young people turn out tomorrow in the so-called Potomac primaries, where voters in both parties go to the polls in Maryland, Virginia, D.C. Barack Obama has a large lead over Hillary Clinton, according to opinion polls. But if he wins many delegates, he could pass Clinton in the overall delegate count. Right now, the two candidates are neck and neck. On the Republican side, John McCain is expected to pick up wins in all three primaries tomorrow, but as we saw this past weekend, Mike Huckabee won 2 out of 3 states, surprising many analysts. Just a reminder, you can listen to all of it live on our website, here-now.org, and for past programs, you can always click on the archives. That's here-now.org. Still to come, the anti-Harry Potter book from Britain. You're listening to Here and Now. Continuing with presidential politics, do you remember the moment during the YouTube debate when Republican candidate and Baptist minister Mike Huckabee was asked, what would Jesus do about the death penalty? Here's his answer.
Jesus was too smart to ever run for public office, Anderson. That's what Jesus would do.
Well, Well, our next guest feels that question deserves a real answer. Stephen Hefner is the creator of the website JesusIn2008.com. It sets up Jesus as a presidential candidate and invites regular people to be delegates who weigh in on what Jesus would actually do on a number of platform issues. And Stephen joins us now from the studios of WRNI in Providence, Rhode Island. Stephen, tell us, first of all, how this works. We know you've set it up sort of like a real political convention. So how does it work?
Well, it's an online political convention. You simply log on, give us your email, make up a username, make up a password, and then you can contribute. Anyone who goes to the site will see that we've set up all the pertinent issues of the day. Obviously, there are several differences between ours and a regular Democratic or Republican political convention. The main one being we already have a candidate who just happens to be Jesus.
Once people have logged on and they are, you know, a delegate and they're sharing their feelings about what Jesus would do, what do you do with their opinions?
I just let them sit on the website, let people discuss them, read them. And gradually, we're hoping to winnow them down to platform planks that the delegates can then, you know, really focus on. We're trying to build a platform here with Jesus as the standard against which we measure the decisions and proposals we make on all these issues.
We know that you're going to then ask people on November 4th to vote. And yet it seems that the real purpose is to get people talking about some of these issues. But I'm wondering, are you finding that people see Jesus differently? For instance, we've had Mary Ludi on the program. She's pastor of the First Church in Cambridge. It's a Congregational Church of Christ. And after that Huckabee moment that we mentioned in her sermon the next Sunday, she said she thought Jesus' position on the death penalty would be clear. He would say that he suffered it, as did anyone else on Calvary Hill. He'd be against it. So have you found, you know, people debating this? Have you found people who say Jesus would be in favor of the death penalty?
We might have had one delegate weigh in so far saying that he might favor it, but we had someone come in and say exactly what you just said, which is that he would, more than anyone, would be against it, having suffered it himself. The idea of Jesus from one person to another is very different. That's what we're trying to tap here. Not just the literal Jesus who comes to us through people quoting scripture and chapter and verse, but it's more important to me to have people conjure up what they feel Jesus is to them.
What are delegates saying that Jesus would do about abortion?
It's kind of all over the lot. You know, you have people weighing in, of course, saying absolutely no abortion under any circumstances, but other people are, you know, actually suggesting that Jesus might take a more circumspect view. One delegate suggested that Jesus might not have a firm position on one thing or another, but he might ask for consistency. If you're going to ban abortion, you also have to be against the death penalty, and you also have to be against invasions like the one in Iraq, where there's hundreds of thousands of people become collateral damage.
We began this discussion again by citing Mike Huckabee, who didn't directly answer the question that was asked him, but maybe that's because it was politically dangerous for him. As it turns out, he himself is very much against the death penalty, and he says based on his faith, he got people off of death row while governor in Arkansas. But are you coming up against that, that people are trying to twist things to fit their politics, you know, in many ways the way politicians feel they have to do?
I'm not coming up against it. As a matter of fact, what we're doing is finding that people recognize that. As people consider contemporary politics in the light, the context we've set up, I think they're going to realize that many of the people who invoke Jesus and Christian values are sort of cherry-picking the issue, and it raises the question, well, if you can raise Jesus to support your arguments against abortion or gay marriage, how would he view health care? Would Jesus see it as a free market issue? How would he view immigration, social programs?
Stephen Hefner, creator of the website JesusIn2008.com, sets up the premise that Jesus is a presidential candidate and invites regular people to be the delegates who weigh in on what Jesus would do with a number of issues. For more, you can go to our website, here-now.org. Stephen, thanks so much for sharing it with us.
Thank you, Robin.
And a quick note, tomorrow on Here and Now, former presidential candidate Gary Hart will tell us just what candidates are doing right now to woo those superdelegates, other politicians and party officials. That's tomorrow. Back in a minute, Here and Now. The world of literature is filled with deep friendships between boys. Gene and Phineas in A Separate Piece, Frodo and Sam in The Lord of the Rings, Peter Pan and all the Lost Boys, or Tom Sawyer, and Huck Finn. Well, now to that list we can add H and Finn in Meg Rosoff's What I Was. In the book, H is an old man now, looking back on the 1960s and his time at St. Oswald's School for Boys, a less than stellar English boarding school. It's his third school. He was expelled from the first two. H leads a pale, featureless life until he meets Finn, a wild child living alone on an island near the school.
He was slim, slightly taller than average, and barefoot, his thick, dark hair unfashionably shaggy. A heavy, old-fashioned fisherman's sweater topped baggy, long shorts, chopped down from trousers and rolled. He looked impossibly familiar, like a fantasy version of myself, with a face I had always hoped would look back at me from a mirror. The bright, flickering quality of his skin reminded me of the surface of the sea. He was almost unbearably beautiful, and I had to turn away, overcome with pleasure and longing and a realization of life's desperate unfairness.
H sees in Finn a way to escape the bland drudgery of school and the low expectations that people have of him. What I Was has won awards for young people's literature in Britain. It's now being published in the U.S. for adults. And author and New England native Meg Rosoff joins us from Milwaukee Public Radio. Welcome.
Thank you.
Tell us about Finn's life, the liberty that might have been so attracting.
One of the main qualities that makes H really sit up and take notice is the fact that Finn's birth was never registered. And so, in complete contrast to his own life, which is all about rules and all about restriction, and you can't do this and you can't do that, here's this guy living a life of absolute freedom. He lives in this hut without any possessions. He fishes for a living. He trades his fish. He lives as if he lived in the Dark Ages. And the simplicity and the purity of that life, you know, his physicality, all that sort of stuff, all kind of combined to make him kind of really iconic figure.
Let's just say right off the bat, we are not giving away the ending because it was so exciting to read it without knowing. But having said that, I found myself thinking, gee, what is that tension between these two young people? Did I feel that tension, you know, with Huckleberry Finn and Tom Sawyer?
Yes, and in fact, the name Finn is kind of a nod of the head both to Huckleberry Finn and to Phineas in a separate piece, so you've got it in one.
So it is a nod to those literary relationships, but maybe because we're reading your book now as adults, we felt conscious of a sexual tension that we didn't feel we noticed in Huck Finn. You know, for a while you wonder, gee, is this a story of young homosexuality? Then I thought, well, no, there is a love that a young man can have for another young man because he wants to be that young man.
Yes, and I don't think it's just between boys or just between men. What I'm really interested in is kind of the edges of emotional life. And when you're off on the edges of emotional life, you find relationships where you can have a kind of deep, passionate love without it necessarily being a great sexual love. Falling in love with somebody who represents all the qualities you wish you had. You know, what you love is how cool somebody is. You know, I think it's only slightly later in life that you find people saying, oh, I love him because he's kind, rather than because, you know, I love the way he wears his sunglasses.
Well, with that in mind, here is H being drawn to Finn, who's leading this exciting life that, by the way, H is not very good at. You know, he just flounders around in the sea and can't fish.
Yeah, he's completely hopeless. He is, and he's incompetent at pretty much everything. And so Finn's just physical competence is something that he is actually deeply in love with, that quality as well.
What are you saying about kids who are so unformed, who are packed off to boarding schools?
Well, you know, it's funny. I think one of the reasons that I started writing this book is because I read an article in the paper in London that said that boarding school admissions had gone up wildly since Harry Potter. And I was going to set it in the present time, but actually boarding schools these days are really fantastic. But in the 1960s, they were really gruesome. And there's a whole generation of British men who were formed by that experience, of this terribly loveless experience. Yeah. There's a lot of fantasy in this book, the writer's fantasy and, of course, the protagonist's fantasy of, you know, what is it that you could find in this absolutely bleak existence? And also, because the narrator is 100 years old, what is it that would make an impression that would last for the rest of your life? What sort of relationship would that be? You know, I mean, people in England have said, how can you write about boys' boarding school in 1962. Obviously, I wasn't anywhere near one. And, you know, in a way, it's fair enough. It would annoy me if an English person came in and started writing about, you know, high school in a Boston suburb. Mm. To me, it's more of a story about being older and looking back on the earlier parts of your life. And also because of all the Harry Potter stuff, I wanted to write the anti-Potter.
How is it the anti-Potter?
Harry Potter has really romanticized in a huge way the whole boarding school thing for kids. And, you know, I mean, boarding school, it can be a terribly romantic place. I mean, I occasionally go in to talk to boarding schools. You know, there was one place that literally was. There was, you know, there was beekeeping and bread making. And I thought, why can't I be at this school? But, I mean, there are elements of it, of that kind of abandonment, which aren't so much addressed in Harry Potter. The pace is so huge. It's all about being a wizard and, you know, there is the fight between good and evil and all that sort of stuff.
By the way, you did grow up here in the Boston area. You've been in Britain for quite a while, which explains the sort of the Madonna accent.
Don't. Well, we'll call it Mid-Atlantic. Mid-Atlantic.
but how much, obviously in reading the book, you've absorbed so much of it. There were little comments here and there that I wouldn't have known. And I still had to sort of look up some of them because they were English, but not the English we speak.
Well, I mean, I've lived there almost 19 years now, and my husband's English and my daughter's English. And, you know, there's the great thing about being an outsider as a writer. I led a pretty ordinary life in America. I grew up in the suburbs of Boston, and, you know, I was a nice girl. I was good at school and all that kind of stuff. And suddenly I go to England, and I'm a foreigner. And I'm very, very fond of England. I love England, and I love the English and all that sort of stuff. But, my God, you know, there's stuff that I just kind of can't believe goes on.
Like?
Well, I suppose like the whole boarding school culture. I mean, you know, I don't know if I can use it as an example, but, you know, I talked to a couple of my friends who'd actually been at boarding school in the early 60s, and there was a big sexual culture between boys. You know, it went on and it was considered just part of growing up. You know, and these were boys who up until the age of 18 were, you know, living like monks, really. They were completely cloistered. They never saw girls. They barely went home for holidays and all that. You know, people don't really talk about it.
Huh. We should say in your book, there's suspicion of that, almost hope for that on the part of gossip mongers at the school, but that is not what's happening with H and Finn. And again, we're not going to give away the ending.
But it is almost metaphorical. It's almost a how do you find a place that says that is very, very loveless, very constrained by rules, and very, very cold, literally and physically.
Meg Rozoff, her book What I Was, has won many awards for young people's literature in Britain. It's now being published in the U.S., and it's a great read for adults as well. Meg, thanks for speaking with us.
Oh, thanks for having me.
And this final note, what is it with those late-night Sunday upsets? Last night, jazz man Herbie Hancock upset the odds makers, taking home the biggest prize of the Grammys, Album of the Year, for River, the Joni Letters, his tribute CD to Joni Mitchell. So if you want to hear our interview with Herbie Hancock from a week ago, go to our website, here-now.org. Amy Winehouse did not win Album of the Year, but stole the show with her satellite performance from London. She also picked up 5 other Grammys, including Song of the Year, for Rehab, to which she returns. Despite the lyrics, Amy Winehouse did decide to go to rehab. Here and Now is a production of WBUR Boston. I'm Robin Young. Please join us again here and now.